Good evening. My name is Tim Summerlin. I'm president here at Shriner University, and I welcome you, all of you here, for this Texas Water Symposium number eight, is that right, over a two-year period. This has been a project that is a collaboration between Texas Tech University here in our Hill Country, Shriner University, and Texas Public Radio. And we have over there with his headset on, Ernie Villarreal, who has been the person recording these things. As you know, they are broadcast over Texas Public Radio so that people who are not here have the chance to listen. And you can have a chance to listen and say, did I really ask that question? And did I say it that way? I thought I was misquoted. But we are pleased that you're here. And I think that the title of tonight's event is one that brings things around in a fine way, rounding things out. I can't remember the title. I'm going to read it right here. Forging Partnerships to Address Complex Water Issues in Texas, : Obstacles, Solutions, Perspectives. So these folks have a lot of responsibility tonight, but they are all people who can handle that responsibility very well. We have an excellent moderator, a person I'm sure many of you know, Robert Potts, here immediately to my left. He is the president of the Dixon Water Foundation, and that is a private foundation supporting sustainable watershed management. He was for a number of years also the general manager of Edwards Aquifer. So a person who certainly knows a great deal about water and about the management of water in our own region. He will be moderating a group that, well, they're fairly moderate themselves in spite of their own convictions, a very civil group of people, and people who bring different perspectives to these issues of partnerships. First of all, we have Kirk Starkey here on the far right, so to speak. He and his family have lived in this area for a number of generations, his great-grandfather being a founder of this county. Angelo State grad, home builder, a manager of commercial real estate properties, rancher, past president of the Upper Guadalupe River Authority, and also a past member of the Guadalupe Blanco River Trust Board, and a number of other boards here in this community. But Kirk Starkey here is one of our experts. And then over here on the left is Mr. David Langford. He is lives up the road a couple of miles from Bat Cave, where his family settled sometime around the middle of the 19th century. So they have a little stake in the natural resources of this region. He's a person who attended both the University of Texas and Texas A&M. I'll simply let you use your eyes. If you're in the radio audience and cannot see any maroon sport coat, then now you know. But I'll let you make your judgment as to where his deepest affections lie. He is the former executive vice president of the Texas Wildlife Association from 1990 to 2002, and is a person who has helped to work to manage millions of acres of properties for the managing the wildlife, the water, the hunting, the fishing, the property rights of the owners, involved in ranching and milling his family for many years. He is also a professional and very successful photographer, and I think wildlife subjects are among his favorites. We appreciate having David Langford here. And then the stranger in our midst, though he is not a stranger with us anymore because he's been around this week, and I'll explain that. Every other year we bring a Woodrow Wilson Fellow to our campus to be with us for a week, to talk to classes, to talk to public groups, to mix with students, and to help educate them in a sort of more informal setting about issues. And this year we brought Mr. Bill Ross here from Seattle, Washington. And Seattle, Washington, Bill Ross, rain yesterday. I think you maybe get to see the connection here. He did promise us early in the week that he would have that impact before the week was over, and we thank him for that. He did do it on the day that he was going to go with the Shriner golf team and play golf. And still about 2 in the afternoon, he kept pronouncing his intention to, he was ready to go out on the course at any time, but he didn't want anybody else's health endangered. But Bill Ross is a person who brings the perspective of a career in public service for many years, including 10 years as the commissioner of Alaska, the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. He's also an adjunct faculty member in the University of Washington Graduate School of Public Affairs. But for the last 20 years and more, he has been the CEO of Ross & Associates, which works to assist public sector agencies in addressing resource issues, environmental issues, finding solutions with the focus on educating stakeholders and creating partnerships to resolve those issues. So you can see that we have three people here with a wealth of experience to bring to what could be a very daunting subject, but we're glad you're here, and I'm going to turn it over now to the professionals, as I say, and to our moderator, Mr. Robert Potts.
Thank you, Dr. Summerlin. We do have a great panel tonight to talk about partnerships in water, and let me tell you how we're going to proceed. To start out, Bill Ross will speak, and then after he speaks, we're going to have Kirk Starkey speak, and then after him, David Langford's going to speak. And then Bill's going to come back up and kind of wrap up the panel discussion, and then when he's finished, then we're going to open it up for questions, and we'll be as these three speakers are talking, be thinking what you'd like to ask them, and we'll save at least 30 minutes at the end for some questions. So, Bill.
Thank you. Well, it's a pleasure and honor to be here in front of you all tonight. As you know now, I am the reason it rained. Everywhere I go, especially when I take my golf clubs, it does rain. And I will be doing my magic tonight so we can get a little bit more tomorrow and Saturday. And hopefully the weatherman will cooperate and let it happen as well. Now, a couple of things I'd like to start with. One is that since I'm the outside expert, we all know that outside experts are those people who live about 50 miles away or more and come into town and borrow your watch and tell you what time it is. So I'm not the one who knows what's going on around here. These gentlemen here do. And so if you ask me any hard questions about what's really happening in Texas, I'll have to say I don't really know. Having said that, I am reminded of the story when thinking about partnerships where someone who was sort of like me, kind of my age and whatnot, and looking on his life and realizing his life was probably more than half over, but wanted to extend his life as long as possible. So he goes to the doctor, and he says, okay, doctor, here's the deal. I've decided to change my ways. You know, I'm going to start exercising. I'm going to go to bed at the right time. I'm not going to have that extra glass of wine, that extra cold beer, that nice cigar, that's gone. You know, all this age stuff, I'm even thinking about giving up sex. Do you think that I will live to be 100? The doctor looks at him and says, I doubt it, but it sure will feel like it. So then he says, well, I got to get a second opinion. He goes and repeats the spiel and to a second doctor. Says, doctor, will I live to be 100? He says, probably, but why would you want to? So environmental partnerships often bring up that sort of, do I have to? Must I go to the dentist, et cetera, et cetera. So since I'm on this college campus, I decided to make this a serious investigation. So I actually went to the library and got a dictionary out and said, looked up partnership, and it had all this stuff about legal contracts and business and money and all of that. And I went, oh, boy, these people don't want to hear about that. That is way too scary. So then, since I am in this college environment, I went to the thesaurus. You know, that's that book that tells you what all those words mean that are sort of like them if you don't want to use them. So I looked it up, and it said that partnership was like affiliation, alliance, combination, connection, togetherness, and my favorite, cahoots. It actually had cahoots in there. So I thought maybe we'd talk a little bit about being in cahoots together for the environment and see what that might mean. What all those words have, though, is a sense of sharing. Okay, so there's some sharing that goes along here, sometimes formally, informally, sometimes implicit, sometimes explicit. And so the question becomes one of, well, why is that so hard? I mean, we all learned how to share when we were kids, and, you know, why would there be so many challenges and obstacles and maybe even some trepidation to sharing with regards to the environment and especially water? Well, I think the answer is pretty simple, which is that, you know, because there's a shared perspective amongst most people that we might not have enough water. And if we don't have enough water, then that makes it pretty hard to think about how are we going to go about sharing that water for all the beneficial uses that that water can and could be put to. So let me offer you a couple of ideas, if you will, about how partnerships tend to work. That is what I do for a living. I'm involved in stimulating, facilitating, mediating, and creating, if hopefully, a space for this collective wisdom to appear that often comes out of the turmoil and tumult of what otherwise would be conflict. And my guess is that those folks down there in the other room are talking about pretty much the same thing, although we know they have the easier topic, don't we? Exactly. So first is that it turns out that people, they often don't know it. And for no, you know, rhyme or reason or no malice aforethought, that they actually have a certain common ground, if you will, that in which they could, if you will, operate together if they recognize that. One of them is that often there are common values, okay? There are common values of either lifestyles or landscapes or the natural features, you know, such as the preservation of ranching, the preservation of native species, etc. So people have that commonality, but they don't know it because they haven't really talked about it or shared it. They often have common interests in sustainable practices or use or utilization patterns, sort of commercial opportunities that might be available, the way in which in-stream flows can benefit more uses than those that one interest might think is primary for them. Often there's values, shared values, you know, species diversity, land management practices that benefit long-term economics, near-term water conservation and restoration activities. And even, and in particular, and I think this is where people often gravitate and wonder if they can get together on this, they have common fears. Okay, fears about what? Who has what power? How levels of government, in particular the federal government, might come in and exert itself on the basis of some of the statutes that we have, or court cases, not knowing whether or not that judge up there who clearly doesn't understand what either side is talking about is going to pick my side versus somebody else's side. So those common fears often provide, a sufficient ground for sharing to be worked out amongst the engaged parties. And the Endangered Species Act is clearly one of the places where that fear lives, if you will, on both sides or all sides of many of these struggles. But most powerfully, there's often a common vision, again, not necessarily shared or articulated together, of how the future and future generations might see things and might see the fruits of the labors of this effort and look back in the future and say thank you to those of us who worked hard to make sure that that vision, which they are the beneficiaries of, actually came into being. Now, there might be also, if you will, besides these values, some sufficient reasons for partnership to actually occur, a little bit more harder edged or more, you know, sort of solid rock ground kinds of things. And even though they too may look difficult at first, one of them is the notion of the death of a thousand cuts. Okay, and what I mean by that is that as water demands grow, okay, individual actions to resolve conflicts are often not sufficiently large enough or robust enough to really make a difference on the overall outcome or the aggregate, if you will, actions across the landscape. So you need a collective response to make sure that enough people change their practices, whoever they are, and this includes city dwellers and anybody who has access to water, to really improve the overall conditions, where one action in and of itself in isolation may very well just be insufficient. The second is this idea, and it hooks up with that notion of fear as well as vision, of controlling one's own destiny in a changing world is often more successful when people work together than when people pursue separate agendas, if you will. Because taken together, the isolation and conflict that can occur, if you have convergence around a path forward, it can often, A, build upon the best ideas, And this is not just about compromise. This is about creating, if you will, the solid basis of the best ideas. It can deflect, if you will, unwarranted outside influences, if you will, if there is sufficiently robust enough. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. And it can also attract allies and resources from even unlikely allies, people that you didn't expect, because there is a lot of interest in seeing problems get resolved, and it can attract a lot of support once it looks like there's something that is moving forward successfully. Now, the other is that there's also the possibility of alignment of actual economic interests with other results, okay, during and from partnership. You know, I mean, in terms of increased hunting opportunities, tourism, alternative power generation, local farming expansion, the continuation of the ranching tradition, they can align with changing residential patterns, even semi-urban lifestyles, to minimize conflicts and to maximize some of these economic opportunities. And there's lots of places around the country that have been able to do that, have been able to take these wonderful landscapes such as this and make them very attractive places, but both preserving that from which it came, but also adjusting it to attract this new income stream, if you will. And I've heard examples where you all are doing that around here, and I'm not surprised given how wonderful the Hill Country is. Now, some characteristics of successful partnerships, if you will, is one of them is that there's a significant use of science and data and information to help define endpoints in particular, so that this is a structured, measurable, identifiable situation that people are working in. That kind of goes back to the legal definition of partnership without calling it legal, is that this isn't about fishing expeditions or let's all get together and sing kumbaya. And again, realize that this is really about we all have to like each other, we all have to convert each other's viewpoints, and it becomes a much more of an ideological struggle. That's not what partnerships tend to be about. People tend to say exactly who they are, believe exactly what they used to believe, but they find that they have this common, again, set of interests and values and whatnot. And I always like to use what President Reagan said, which was, you know, trust but verify, and make sure that what you're focusing on is actually grounded well enough in the science that people don't end up arguing significantly about is this working or is this not working. The other is that inclusiveness. Okay, so there needs to be some inclusiveness of those interests who are necessary for success, and that's not always easy to define because I think there's a natural tendency that we want to hang with those who agree with us. And when I used to lobby for the state of Alaska back in Washington, D.C., I was always amazed to see how many people hired lobbyists who knew Senator Ted Stevens, the senator from Alaska, in order to make sure that he would promote views he already believed in. And I would say, do we have a problem with Ted? Is Ted not on our side here? How come we aren't hiring some people to talk to the Democrats? Oh, no, we couldn't possibly talk to them. Well, things that often were in the best interest of the state of Alaska never happened because only the people who already believed in it got together and said yes, and the people who didn't know why that was a good thing for them never heard about it, and so they continued to vote no. So this notion of a big tent is often necessary to build bridges that are sufficient enough to drive across these results and to prevent the repetition of the past war. The past war is very easy to fall back into and have occur yet another time. Another is the characteristic of partnerships, which is you would think is fairly easy to do, turns out sometimes to be pretty difficult, is you have to be able to celebrate success. You have to have the willingness to say that things are happening positively. Often, let's just wait and see. Let's just wait and see. Well, things don't happen that way. In real life, things happen and happen and happen and happen and happen, and then you get someplace. And so you've got to have the ability to step back at various points in time and say thank you to yourselves and to others in reward for actions. And in water, this is really important. The reason it's really important, and I'm not an expert on Texas water law, but Western water law, and we'll say Texas is in the West here, is really complicated. And it is predicated on a couple of things in particular. One is the notion of water rights. Okay, and so that water, wherever it was and whoever else used to own it, so to speak, or have access to use it, now becomes the property right of someone specifically in certain amounts, used in certain ways, claimed in certain instances, etc. And so, you know, under the rubric of use it or lose it, people are often in the position of needing to show and claim up and use that water. And so when you ask people to say, okay, so why don't you use less of it? And so improve your practices and whatnot. The question is, well, whatever happens to my right? I mean, how come I'm going to be punished, so to speak, for decreasing the amount of water I use, which may then move to a junior water right, someone who may be profligate in the use of their water, et cetera. So finding a way to reward those people who over time have already put in place many conservation practices and whatnot, have improved their land management, et cetera, is both difficult to do, but absolutely, I think, essential to do. Now, the other thing that often is the case, and you know, sometimes I want to say it's absolutely necessary, sometimes I think maybe you can do it without it, is that you often need an integrating process or structure or champion. Okay, these things don't just happen. There's a lot of work involved in them. There's a lot of, you know, do-si-do, what about you? You go first. How about this? Some way for that to create, if you will, a spirit, if not of trust, at least of confidence that this is working. What I like to say is you have to get the right people being asked the right questions in the right way. And that is part art and part just common sense on how to do that. It depends on the issues, it depends on the people, depends on the culture, depends on the goals. But without that, it's very difficult to create sustained, enduring success. You can get some things to happen, but then it just kind of falls by the wayside. Now, the other thing that's combined with this, so to speak, is that these partnerships, and again, I don't want to go back to the legal definition or the definition that is often legal, but they're often top-down and bottom-up at the same time. And by top-down, I mean they often are either seeking or operating under statutes, regulations, court orders, or the fear and threat thereof, or the hope and aspiration that you can create something that will give it, if you will, that context that's much more from the top down. But they're going to definitely, and the heavy lifting is going to be done from the people who are most affected by and necessary to conduct the work, the analysis, the implementation, and the trust building that's going to be needed for success. And without that bottom up, these things don't work. They are not partnerships at that point. They are just responses to inputs coming from, in most cases, the legal structure that we have. And the fights and struggles will then go back into the legal structure, either through the courts or through lobbying the legislature or through, you know, various regulatory decisions that the authorities that have the responsibilities for managing these resources, such as water or the species and critters that live within or depend upon that water, rely upon. So those are just some thoughts that I wanted to share about what it means to think about partnerships, what it means to potentially wonder, if you will, what is necessary for them to work and how they might operate. And I'll come back later and obviously interact as appropriate with the questions that once we hear what's actually happening and why it is that these folks think partnerships might have some ability to be very successful here in Texas as well.
Great.
Thank you.
Well, I'm Kirk Starkey, and those of you who know my bio know that I'm born and raised here. My job tonight is to basically represent the rancher in the ranching community of Kirk County. Most of you who know ranchers know them as pretty independent, strong-willed, opinionated, hardworking bunch of people. They do make their living off the land, and so, yes, as a group, they are very concerned with the land and how they can maximize their ability to make a living and possibly pass those ranches on to future generations. Bill touched on one of the issues that I think is out there, and that is fear. The Endangered Species Act just scares the bejeebers out of most people. They do not trust it. They fear that it is a government guy from some unseen place that is going to come onto their place, tell them that he has found this particular species of animal or bug or insect, and that they can no longer use their property in the way that they have. Water is also extremely important, as we have found out in the last 18 months when it didn't rain until Bill showed up, that without water, you cannot have
very successful ranching. And most of the folks that I know are trimming herds or selling herds. They're very concerned about their wildlife, which is an economic generator and a pretty big generator for most of the landowners here in Kerr County. So yes, they are very concerned about water and how to retain water, have water available. The agricultural crop usage of water is pretty much all dry land farming. I only know of one place where there is a pivot in Kerr County. So we don't have watering activities like you will see down around Gonzales and further south or out on the South Plains in areas like that where they do a lot of heavy watering to grow their various crops. Forging partnerships is going to be a tough road, primarily done by education and showing the independent rancher that, one, he understands the entity that wants to partner with him, what their goals are, what their message is, what their true intent is. And educating the rancher that what this entity and that partnership have is going to make his business of ranching a better. For example, if you look at the Kerrville Wildlife Management Area and some of the things that they have developed over the past two or three decades, they will show you that with proper range management, brush clearing, prescribed burning, rotational grazing, and other practices, that you can grow more grass and therefore you can run more head per acre than you can if you don't do those things. What does that do for water? In the end, it allows the rainfall, which is all the water we ever get, to percolate down into the ground to fill the aquifers so that your wells on those places that they're using to fill their water troughs and their water tanks don't go dry, that the spring flow, if they're lucky enough to live by live water, that those spring flows continue to flow and flow well, that they can use that water to benefit their ag wildlife needs. Education, reducing of fear, but also transparency on what the entities do, say, and what they ultimately mean will be a way to try to move forward in forging partnerships, in my opinion.
Thank you, Ben.
Howdy.
Howdy. Howdy.
Hello.
That left me a lot of time. I'll just take it all up. Listen, thank you. I'm David Lankford, and I'm really happy to be here, and I want to thank Shriner University, Texas Tech, Texas Public Radio, and Hill Country Alliance. And in the spirit of full disclosure, I serve on the advisory board of Hill Country Alliance as well. And I think I know about half the people in here. I see a lot of master naturalists and some members of the press and some members of leadership of other organizations that we partner with frequently. And, you know, after the colon in the title of the program is Obstacles, Perspectives, and Solutions. And I'm going to talk a little bit about those three general areas. In the introductions, it was mentioned that my family, with my wife sitting there in the back row, was we came here with one ranch in one side of the family in 1887 and another side in 1851, and my wife's family was already here then, so I'm the newcomer in all of this. But the ranch that was right up the road from our house, our cousin lives in, and our great-grandfather built that ranch house in 1887. And he built that ranch house because there was a spring there. That spring still supplies that house and those pens and those hunters' camps that whole operation is still supplies it with water. My wife and I walked Block Creek that goes right through our part of the ranch. Incidentally, the ranch has been divided up over all those years, but nobody, I have one uncle that sold his part to pay for medical treatments about 30 years ago, but nobody else has ever sold any of the ranch. So we were walking along the main creek that flows through that normally flows through the ranch. And even in this drought, the worst 18-month stretch, including any 18-month stretch of the drought of the 50s, there's still spring flows all over that property. So our family has spent, since 1887, we've been putting water into the aquifers. And I don't much like the big urban areas stealing it for our efforts for what we've been doing for six generations. That's also part of full disclosure, so you'll know where my perspectives come from. We want to protect our springs, and we want to protect the water that we put in the ground. We don't have any center pivots. Most of our neighbors are multi-generation neighbors. There's no developments. There's no golf courses. All of our efforts are putting water into the aquifers. The perspective that I want to visit with about is that we've talked about these partnerships, and I'm going to give you two that worked, two that have worked in the past spectacularly. The first one is the Wildlife Management Property Tax Valuation, Proposition 11, a constitutional amendment in 1995 that amended the Texas Constitution that extended the agricultural valuation to wildlife management. First comment, everybody calls it an exemption, an ag exemption or a wildlife exemption. It's not an exemption. We pay taxes. Churches are exempt. Ranchers are not exempt. They have a special valuation on their property, constitutionally approved. They receive that special valuation mainly because those cows and those deer don't go to school. That's why you get a break on the taxes. Here's the partnership that developed in 1995 around that issue to pass the constitutional amendment. I'm going to go down. I'm sure I'm going to miss some. The first was then Governor Bush, Lieutenant Governor Bob Bullock, Speaker of the House Pete Laney, of course, our association, Texas Wildlife Association, Texas and Southwestern Cattle Raisers Association, Sierra Club, Audubon Society, Texas Farm Bureau, Nature Conservancy of Texas, Sportsman's Conservationists of Texas, Texas Sheep and Goat Raisers Association, Exotic Wildlife Association, Davis Mountains Trans-Pecos Heritage Association, Riverside and Landowners Protection Coalition, Texas Landowners Council, Environmental Defense Fund, Safari Club International, Houston Safari Club, Dallas Safari Club, Ducks Unlimited, Quail Unlimited, National Wild Turkey Federation, Texas Bighorn Society, all the wildlife management co-ops. The authors of the bill and the amendment were Democrats and Republicans. Clyde Alexander was the principal author, Democrat from Athens. He's now the chief of staff of the current Speaker of the House in Texas. Susan Combs was a Republican House member of the Texas House at that time. She's now the comptroller, who actually administers the taxes of the state. And then all the editorial boards, TV. I mean, I traveled around with these authors of that amendment all over the state and visited editorial boards, and I never saw one that was not in favor of that constitutional amendment. So keep in mind now, here's a partnership to pass a good idea, and the continuum runs from environmental defense to the cattle raisers, all working for the same good idea. It was a popular idea with a broad spectrum of support from people who vote. On election day, it passed 62-38. And that's a pretty good win. I don't care what kind of game you're playing. The second example of a successful partnership in Texas was the brown-headed cowbird trapping program. That started around Fort Hood, and about the reason that program started, a lot of people don't realize the full history of it. It started because, you know, Fort Hood was in fact taken away from cattlemen in World War II as a place to train armor, tanks. Those cattlemen never got their ranches back, as they were promised by the federal government, but they did allow them to continue grazing because when you shoot those tanks, when the tanks shoot, and it's live fire, they start a bunch of fires. I mean, you start shooting tanks around, you're going to blow lots of stuff up, and you're going to start a lot of fires. Well, the cattle keep the countryside grazed down so that those fires are manageable. One of the things Aldo Leopold said, you use grazing appropriately. Well, here's probably an idea that he didn't think about on appropriate use of grazing. So that's how it started. So here's the, everybody that I just mentioned in the Proposition 11 partnership, add to that the high schools, because the shop classes built the cowbird traps. The school boards, of course, which had to approve it. Now, these are pretty much locally all around Fort Hood, which is a pretty good deal to be around. Local governments, the Chambers of Commerce, Convention and Visitors Bureaus, the Department of Defense, and Army. That spectrum, that included everybody from the Sierra Club to the people who really did have and do have black helicopters. So it still worked because of the common purpose of everybody. Now, here's the results of that partnership. The results of Proposition 11 was there's a lot of land intact that's still contributing water to aquifers and surface water. The results of the cowbird trapping was they reduced the parasitism on those endangered species of black cap vireo on Fort Hood, increased the nesting success of the black cap vireos, so much so that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service recommended downlisting the black cap vireo from endangered to threatened. Now, Washington still has not acted upon that recommendation, but not only is there a potential downlisting of an endangered species, but the Army still gets to train in a no fire danger. Here's some unexpected, unanticipated results of that partnership. It expanded to the entire hill country. We've got traps. I mean, we're a long way from Fort Hood, and we've got traps all over this country. On our family's ranches, we have their five traps. They're active right now. So it spread everywhere in the Texas hill country, in the habitat of the black cap vireo. It then proceeded from there into a recovery credit system whereby the ranchers and property owners and farmers around Fort Hood are actually incentivized, talk about turning the Endangered Species Act upside down and backwards, in favor of the landowner. They are incentivized and paid to create black cap vireo habitat, which appears when you graze and burn things pretty easily through prescribed burns. So you've got increasing, it also has a lot to do with the downlisting, so you have increasing black cap vireo habitat, you've got ranchers getting paid to keep doing what they've been doing forever, and you got the Army still able to train while we're in the middle of the war. A personal story, certainly not anticipated. Now listen, there's no science to back this up. This is just personal observation, but I spent all of my life on that ranch where Myrna and I now live. And I can tell you, and again, I don't have any science to prove this, but we've got more, I don't think I ever saw a scarlet tanager till 4 or 5 years ago, or a vermilion flycatcher, certainly not a painted bunting. I mean, we've got songbirds like nobody's business on that ranch, so much so that we now have a nature photography destination business based on the Army wanting to continue training around Fort Hood. So there's another partnership, so it can morph into a lot of things, including, as Bill said, unlikely allies. Got a couple of comments about obstacles. I'm going to talk about two of them. The second, which Kirk already mentioned, the second, at least in my opinion, the second most important obstacle to partnerships is most of the time, or maybe not most of the time, but often, frequently, you leave a constituency out. Sometimes that's inadvertent. Most of the time, it's not. And the example of top-down, as that was already discussed, and not working from the bottom up is a perfect example. Listen, as the CEO of Texas Wildlife Association, it used to really upset me. Upset's too mild a word. It used to upset me, which I'll use rather than using a stronger word. It used to upset me to go into a room, and there is a room. In the room sat primarily bureaucrats and academics, and my apologies to the bureaucrats and academics in the room, but primarily they're sitting in the room telling us what they're going to do with our land. You know, you two people, y'all are too stupid to figure this out. And even if you could figure it out, you couldn't possibly be trusted with these decisions. So, the top down is that, you know, here's how we're going to administer, as long as we're picking on the Endangered Species Act, here's how we're going to administer the Endangered Species Act, and you leave out the people who are out there on the ground. So most of the folks who shoulder the larger part of the burden themselves are generally left out of the proceedings. So if you're going to put a table together and seat people in a partnership effort, start with the people who are the first people you ought to invite are the people who are going to be most affected by the policies that you're thinking about implementing. The number one issue, and particularly when you're talking about water, y'all got a couple of handouts which will be available on the website for those in the radio audience. One of those fact sheets was called Voluntary Land Stewardship Benefits to the Waters of Texas, and it talks about how land-based conservation practices can benefit water. Well, the number one problem with water and the number one problem with partnerships involving natural resources is natural resource illiteracy. The things that are outlined on that page, most of the citizens, particularly the urban citizens down there in San Antonio, since we're talking about the Hill Country, they don't have a clue that anything that happens on the land has any bearing at all on water. Somehow, that has to be in this partnership, in a partnership effort, in maybe a formal education way dealing with the Texas Education Agency, but mostly in an informal way dealing with partnerships, is to inform the general public that there are other benefits to society of open space rather than development. Most people think, oh, but all these fat cat ranchers up here in the Hill Country, they can't wait to sell their ranch so that it can be developed. That's not the case. There are some that want to do that, but most people want to hang on to their ranch and pass it on, certainly in the Hill Country. So we have to work together to get the general public to understand that open space has a lot of other valuable characteristics that benefit them. They recharge, open space recharges aquifers, helps control floods, cleans surface water, provides recreation, sequesters carbon, gives us scenic views, and on and on and on and on, enhances environmental flows, which helps the bays and estuaries. It is a situation that we have to get under control, and probably working with partnerships is the best way to do that. Because right now we direct all the incentives towards covering everything with asphalt and rooftops. We, as a society, we have figured out how to value rural land or any kind of real estate. We value it to sell. We don't value it to keep. It doesn't have any value in the public's mind to recharge aquifers. It only has value as development potential, which is fine for those that want to develop their land. But those of us that don't want to develop the land would like to have people recognize that there are other values. There are other values that are important to land. So we've got to value open space differently, and especially when it comes to water. And partnerships are really the best way to do that. And I'll close with why, which is a quote on that same handout I mentioned from Lyndon Johnson, 1947. Saving the water and the soil must start where the first raindrop falls. If we're going to do something about water, we have to start where it starts. And it starts as rainfall, and that rainfall in Texas starts by falling on private land. And we've got to somehow, through partnerships, as Proposition 11 and the cowbird trapping thing have illustrated the broad spectrum of support once people understand the idea. We have to get people to understand and all work in as partners to understand that open space and those multi-generation and the new ranchers that just bought new ranches, that they need to be incentivized and kept in place because that's where the first raindrop falls. I thank you.
Let me tell a small anecdote from my part of the world just to add on to the remarks that we've heard. Property rights are a very strong component of the foundation of the way in which America has been founded and the way in which, as David said, it has developed. And up in the Puget Sound area, how many people have been to Seattle? Okay, it's a beautiful part of the world. It has had significant growth ever since the works came, obviously exacerbated and accelerated in the last 25 years or so. And there are 17 Native American tribes who live in Puget Sound, and they each have treaty rights. They have signed treaties with the United States government that promised them, as with many of the other tribes in the Northwest, that they would have access to their customary hunting and fishing grounds. And over the course of since 1855, when that treaty was developed, they have seen the erosion of the habitat that would support their ability to do so. And in the 1980s, they filed suit in federal court to enforce their treaty rights. And a famous decision by Judge Bolt established that they were had access to 50% of all of the harvestable shellfish and salmon and whatnot that existed, and that would be considered a fair share under his interpretation of the treaty. Over the course of this development, which resulted in estuarine loss, riparian damage, damming of rivers, water flow runoff pollution, and as people settled along the shoreline, basically the transformation of the nearshore habitat and the rearing areas, the amount of fish available went down and down and down and down. So pretty soon they were looking at 50% of 10% of what there used to be. And they have not yet filed suit under Bolt 2 to say, well, why don't you let us run the habitat then, since you all have screwed this up so much? And I kept listening to you, David, and every time you said ranchers, I said Indians. Okay, because of the way in which the value of that land, and it's very interesting to hear Native Americans speak about, hey, our property rights. We got a treaty. A treaty is the second highest law of the land after the Constitution. It is much higher than a statute or anything else that might establish, if you will, what those rights would be. And so all of those salmon have been listed under the Endangered Species Act up there because they're significantly threatened or endangered. And the federal government came in and said, oh, great, we're going to run Puget Sound now. And everybody said, oh, boy, this is not going to be pretty. And they didn't want to do it. They didn't know how to do it. And, in fact, nobody knew how to do it because you can't find enough culprits. I mean, you can't find enough people lining them up on the wall and shoot them and say, well, we fixed that problem, because it's everybody. It's everybody is involved in this. And so up there, in the guise of and under the direction of a partnership, we created the first federally approved endangered species recovery plan that was developed by the local communities who were going to have to implement it, because there aren't enough point sources and, again, regulated sources that you can find and say, if you change your practices. It isn't Boeing is doing this, okay? I mean, you can tell Boeing all the things it needs to do to improve its practices. They need lots of permits and whatnot. But that isn't going to save those fish. What's going to save those fish is the actions of thousands and thousands and thousands of people day in and day on, day in and day out. And fascinating enough, the tribes had the same skepticism. Here you go again. Oh, boy, a whole bunch of broken promises. We can't wait to be in partnership with you people again. And we worked that out. It took several years to establish the scientific benchmarks, if you will, of what it meant to recover the fish. And the attitude that came out of the state and the locals was that not just to have these fish survive, in other words, become museum fish, but that we would actually pursue coming back to harvestable levels of salmon in Puget Sound, where people could actually harvest them. Sport fishermen, of course, but also tribal fisheries who have the right to 50% of this, whatever the amount is. And in so doing, that broke the logjam, built the trust that the tribes felt that this was not just about, you know, pretending that they take all the losses while the development continues apace where the white man's money is, flipping this stuff and building the condos and doing all the things that create value, if you will, in an economic sense that way. Now, we shall see. It is now covered. People have the capacity now to perform actions as long as they are consistent with this plan. This plan has a 50-year horizon, so it provides that kind of coverage. We'll see if whether or not it's implemented. It will be very expensive. The governor, when this first became, if you will, the partnership's product, established a new agency, actually a state agency called the Puget Sound Partnership. Okay, it's not the state agency of partnerships. It is the Puget Sound Partnership. She put $500 million in the budget to start to augment the significant amount of funding that's already been done that is directed then at trying to implement these things that would cause us to believe that we have progress along this path. So I want to just emphasize that the people most affected often are the landowners and those with property rights, but they're often unusual in their sources of where those rights might come from or where that skepticism might come from, and including them is extremely important. So I just wanted to share that anecdote because, again, the way in which you talked, you could have been Billy Frank, senior elder from the Puyallup tribe, talking about the way it is and the way it should be. Now, the one difference between you and Billy is Billy will have, before he left the room, hugged everyone in it. Everyone. He is the biggest hugger I know. Right. So I think we're now ready to turn this back over to Robert
right.
and continue the program.